So I'm looking to see if we have critical mass here.
It's recording right now. I don't think the chair is ready to start the meeting, Corinne, or...
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. Monday, February 1st. Let's start with a roll call.
Representative Hernandez is excused. Representative Levy.
Here by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith is here by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke is excused.
Hopefully not. Reschke is here by video.
Oh, sorry.
Thanks.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Here by video. Thank you. We have two items on our agenda for today, two public hearings, and for those of you not entirely familiar with our process, these are public hearings only. We do not have work sessions scheduled. We will not be taking action as a committee on these bills today. We will have public hearings only. We will start, however, with the informational meeting. Mr. Alanak, I'm convening the informational meeting now.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the informational meeting is a refresher course, so to speak, on the taxation of interstate broadcasters. And Kate Harger should be somewhere on the video stream to present you that information.
Thank you, Chris. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Caitlin Harger. I am with the Legislative Revenue Office. Oops, wrong screen. Hold on 1 second. Okay, clicked too fast. I apologize. Let's try that again. Okay. So today I am going to present an informational meeting or an informational session about the taxation of interstate broadcasters within Oregon. I do have some slides talking about the bill that we'll discuss in the public hearing, but I'm going to wait to cover that until we're in that hearing. And I'll provide some background and kind of a general overview of where we are with this topic of taxation as I go through the slides. I'm not sure how that happened. Sorry about this. Okay. All right. So first, I'm going to cover some terms that are very important in our discussion about interstate broadcasters. Specifically, these are terms that show up in corporate taxation that you are briefly familiar with from our orientation discussion last week, I believe. And I'll talk about these in the context to which they apply to this discussion. So the first term is nexus. And if a state has, or if a corporation has nexus with state, that means that the state can tax that business based on its connection to the state. So if a business has nexus with the state, they are then taxable by that state. And so this is one of the key considerations that will come up later on when we talk about the history behind this, because there have been some disagreements regarding who had nexus in the past, but also some changes to establishing nexus as technology has advanced. The second key term or concept I want you to be familiar with is apportionment. And this is how in corporate taxation, multi-state income is apportioned to different states. So if you have a company, a C corporation that's operating all over the United States, how do we decide which portion of their federal income is attributed to Oregon? And federal taxable income would be the amount of income that's subject to tax within the United States. And state taxable income, in our case, would be the amount of income subject to tax within Oregon divided by that share. Or you can also think of this as the share of federal income that a state taxes. And then finally, I want to briefly mention our single sales factor calculation. So Oregon's general apportionment factor is based on the ratio of Oregon sales to U.S. sales. So that ratio or that apportionment factor is then multiplied by federal taxable income, and that's how we arrive at Oregon taxable income for our starting point. I've put Oregon sales in bold here because specifically what we'll talk about in the next couple slides are how are sales related to broadcasting actually sourced to Oregon. So this is kind of the focus or one main focus of the policy discussion moving forward. Now, some key details specifically regarding interstate broadcasters. First, who is an interstate broadcaster? And second, which income of a broadcaster is apportioned to Oregon and how? So starting with the first question, who is an interstate broadcaster? I've put the definition from statute here, and I'll talk about it in a little bit, but this definition dates back to 1989, when Oregon first established broadcaster-specific statutes. And this defines a broadcaster as someone engaged, a company engaged in broadcasting. And specifically, broadcasting means the activity of transmitting any one-way electronic signal by conduits of communication. And so you can think back to around 89 or the early 90s when the internet was not available or like it was today, and how this definition applied to a much narrower scope at the time. But now, given how many ways we communicate or access content via the internet, this definition might have a broader scope. And then secondly, so this other topic on the right-hand side, which income is apportioned? This is a specific question that was tied to a case with Comcast in Oregon that I believe was settled, or I believe was finalized in 2018, decided in 2018. And this said that Oregon statute defines broad, so Oregon statute says that interstate broadcasters, if you are an interstate broadcaster, all of your income is subject to apportionment using the method for broadcasting apportionment. And so what that means is that any company that's engaged in broadcasting, aside from tangible personal property and real property, which are the two things that are explicitly stated in statute as not being apportioned this way, all other income is apportioned using the broadcaster provisions, which I'll discuss in a few slides. This is important because if you think of a company like Disney, for example, they might be engaged in interstate broadcasting because they are broadcasting children's movies or content across cable or satellite TV providers, for example. But they also have theme parks. And this is something that's come up in past testimony to the committee over the period of time, is that in this case, their theme park income, based on the Comcast decision, presumably would be subject to the interstate broadcaster apportionment methods. And so kind of one policy question here is, what part of our of a broadcaster's income do we want to tax based on the interstate broadcaster statutes? I think I have a little bit of delay. Okay, now I'm gonna briefly describe how the industry is set up. This is a lot of information. And this is a chart that LRO produced as part of our Interstate Broadcaster research report that we did over the 2019 interim. And we can think of the industry as having kind of three channels: content production, distribution, which is shown in the center, and then the end user. End users are all of us when we are watching or consuming TV or content via any method that we do so. That involves electronics. Distribution, or how that is related to how that content gets to the end user, and content production is where we will start. So we think of content production as coming from three broad sources. One would be national networks. These are the networks that were historically broadcasting, so networks like ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox. And they produce content and national ads, which they send to distribution and then to end users. Cable networks are the other channels that you might be familiar with if you subscribe to TV, places like the Disney Channel or MTV or the Weather Channel. Any of those channels that require a cable subscription to access and aren't broadly broadcasted back in the days when you could use an antenna to access the national networks. And then finally, the last group of content producers we call consumer direct. And these are things like Netflix or Amazon creating their own original content and providing it to the end user via the internet. So we think of content production as falling into one of those three categories. And then next we move to distribution. So typically this content is distributed via cable, satellite, telecom, or internet. And so if you think of cable, this would be something like Comcast. Satellite would be something like Dish. Telecom, I believe, is something like, and I think AT&T has a telecom service. But this is the bill that an end user pays. So kind of this intermediary between the content producer and the end user are these distribution channels.
Representative Reschke has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Caitlin.
I lost audio.
Reschke, can you unmute yourself? There we go.
Is that better?
Yes.
Thank you.
I could put my mask on and then you could try to read my lips, but okay, we'll go with this. So with the three content production groups you have there, national networks, cable networks, and consumer direct, where would somebody like Disney Plus or Apple Plus fall in those groups, or are you going to get to that later?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Reschke, that's a great question. I would think of these groups as potentially not mutually exclusive. So Disney Plus, I would say specifically, would fall into consumer direct, because you can access that without a cable subscription or similar.
Okay.
However, if you're watching the same content on the Disney Channel via cable, then I would say that was in the cable network, if that clarifies.
That helps a lot. Okay. Thanks.
Perfect. Yep. So I described the main distribution channels. Then the distributors provide content and local ads to end users or viewers in exchange for subscription fees. The content producers are given license fees by the distributors. And so this chart kind of shows the movement of revenue between these different channels of the industry. Now, briefly, I'm going to talk about the policy history here. I know some of you are very familiar with this since it's been a topic in the Revenue Committee for a while, but I know also that this can be really dense. So starting back in 1989, I mentioned earlier, that's when the first broadcaster-specific apportionment statutes were adopted in Oregon. So this means that in 1989, Oregon decided we're going to tax this industry differently than just our broad apportionment taxation. And so from 1989 until 2013, the audience method of apportionment was used for broadcasters in Oregon. And that means that your apportionment factor, or the percentage that we're multiplying by your income to see how much is sent to Oregon, that would be calculated as Oregon audience over United States audience. And so, for example, if Oregon represented 1% of your national audience, then 1% of your federal income would be applied or apportioned to Oregon. So that was the policy. Now, there was some disagreement over key issues related to this policy. And so I've tried to highlight both perspectives conceptually here. One key issue was nexus. So whether or not the broadcasters in question had a tie to Oregon that established nexus, meaning that the Department of Revenue and the state were able to tax that industry or those individual taxpayers. And there were a number of court cases that we detail in our LR report, but basically the court cases highlight the difference here. DOR believed at the time that industry did have nexus, and so their tax liability is shown conceptually by this blue dotted line that's higher up on the chart. Whereas the Motion Picture Association, which was then the Motion Picture Association of America, believes that they did not have nexus, and so their tax liability is much lower than DOR's perspective. So the goal here is to show the differing perspectives at the time while we were still under the audience method. Then moving forward from the audience method in 2013, Oregon adopted a new temporary provision which detailed a new type of apportionment for broadcasters. This was called commercial domicile. And the idea behind this was that the direct customer of the broadcaster, we would apportion sales based on the location of that direct customer as determined either by the business headquarters or if you were a subscriber by your billing address. So for example, if I have Disney Plus and I'm located in Oregon, my billing address is in Oregon, then my Disney Plus subscription would be sourced to Oregon. That's kind of straightforward. Now, if we were talking not about a subscriber, but about a distributor. So let's say I'm a national network and I am distributing content to distributor X, who is located in California. Then those sales, because they aren't touching Oregon within that direct exchange, are not sourced to Oregon. So those sales would be sent to California, even if viewers in Oregon were watching that content. And again, this is a high level overview. There's lots of complexity here. So I'm of course happy to answer any questions. And so commercial domicile was a temporary provision that Oregon adopted for 2014 to 2019. There were, I think, three bills in this period, with the idea being some of the court cases would get resolved. The Department of Revenue started collecting data on the broadcasters to try to better understand the issue. And so some time allowing these things to pass. Based on that data in our LRO report, this is a combination of data and some of those court cases being decided in favor of the department, I would say. And in our report, we found that there was a $10 million average annual decline in revenue from switching from audience to commercial domicile. Now, again, I want to remind you that pre-commercial domicile, there were two different perspectives, and the court cases were not determined until, I think, much later, like towards the end of 2018 or 2019. So two differing perspectives, we switched to this temporary provision. Over time, some things are resolved and we get more data. And the finding of our report was that this was a $10 million decline, this policy change. And now I'll talk a little bit about where we are today. So this bill, I believe, passed out of the Senate committee in 2020, but did not become law at the end of the session.
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt because it may be that the question relates to the thought that you just completed prior to this, bringing us up to date on the history of this. Representative Reschke, did you have a question now?
I did, and thank you very much, Madam Chair. Caitlin, the $10 million average, is that per year or is that $10 million over the 5 or 6 years there?
So Rep. Reschke and Madam Chair, this is $10 million per year, and it's an average over the time period. And due to disclosure issues, we can't provide like an annual breakdown of that.
Yep, that's fine. I just wanted to see if it was in total or if it was per year. So thank you.
Mm-hmm, of course. Okay, and so today, 2020, there was a bill, there was agreement between parties. It did not become law. Now we're in 2021, and we're going to be discussing a bill later in the public hearing that is identical to the last version, or the version that passed out of the Senate committee in the 2020 session. But what happened is this temporary provision was only active through 2019. And so in 2020, current law returned to the audience method of apportionment, which is the method of apportionment that we had prior to 2014. So we switched back to that audience method. And so I want to draw your attention to something here, which is that now, instead of having two perspectives, we have one line. And this is because over time, there have been changes to the interpretation of nexus. And as of the 2020 session, I believe the MPA testified that they were no longer contesting nexus, that they believed based on the changes over time, the department and MPA were on the similar pages regarding nexus, and so it wasn't an issue. So those two perspectives have kind of converged over time as things have changed. And now our current law stance is the audience method, and that's as of the year, the tax year 2020. I'm going to briefly highlight some things that came out of our report that I want to draw the committee's attention to. So the first is that broadcasting definition I mentioned at the beginning is pretty broad, meaning that any one-way signal that is transmitting content can be interpreted as broadcasting. And I think this came up last time we discussed in the committee, and I believe it was Representative Reschke that asked, what about podcasts? Would that count? And I think in LRO's view, that would count because we're sending content via a one-way signal. So one of the findings of our report is that this is very broad. Remember, this definition is from 1989. And so technology has changed drastically, and the scope of this could potentially be increasing as time moves on. So just kind of identifying that for the committee and whether or not that's the policy intent of the committee in today's environment, or perhaps it's a flag for future consideration. And now, so I'm going to draw your attention back to this diagram I showed at the beginning. The focus here, I think, on the changes moving forward are, what about this consumer direct method? So now that we're moving more and more towards things like Disney Plus or CBS All Access or these direct-to-consumer methods, does the law effectively capture these changes in the market? And so, like I mentioned, our current law is audience method. So the baseline for any revenue estimates or implications, it would be in comparison to that audience method. And the policy that we'll discuss later specifically is going to try to deal with some of the issues related to the audience method. So we'll change the apportionment method for some of the receipts, which have been, I would say, the basis for a lot of disagreement between the department and industry. And we'll try to clarify which sales the apportionment method applies to. And so with that, I'm happy to answer any additional questions. And I have a few additional slides once we're in the public hearing, but I'll hold off on those until then. Thank you.
Thanks. So, Mr. Alanak, are we ready at this point to open public hearings?
Yes, I think you can open that, and then Kate can talk about what the bill does. She has that combined in the slides that she has. So I think now is a good time to open the public hearing.
Okay, good. I am opening, there's my gavel, opening the public hearing on House Bill 2455.
All right, and thank you, Madam Chair. So again, for the record, I'm Caitlin Harger from the Legislative Revenue Office. As Chris mentioned, I have a slide here that goes through the different sections of the bill that we're discussing today. And I put in bold the main policy points here. Excuse me. So Section 1 describes just conforming language that is standard to bills. Section 2 focuses on the definition of broadcasting and total gross receipts. Excuse me. It also describes apportionment options for broadcasters. It removes obsolete references from the bill later on. And the main other policy change, I would say, is in Section 5, where it defines applicability to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2020. So if you think back to that chart I showed, we switched back to audience method in 2020. And so this bill would revert, would take any policy changes the committee makes now and apply them to tax year 2020 moving forward. And on this slide, I'll discuss a little bit more in depth about the bill differences here. So if you look down at the bottom set of bullet points, the changes in the bill to the apportionment calculation are as follows. So first, one of the areas that industry has maintained, they have a very hard time identifying the location of their customer or their audience, is when a network is licensing to a subscription service. So, excuse me, for example, so as National Network A is licensing to Netflix, for example, just making up an example, and Netflix is then I'm a subscriber of Netflix, so I access that Netflix content in my house. Well, because my transaction is with Netflix, Netflix believes that that information is proprietary, or they could believe that and do in some cases. And so the national network that is licensing to Netflix doesn't have a way of establishing where their audience member is located. And so in that case, the audience method can be difficult from the industry's perspective to actually identify the correct apportionment ratio. So one solution that came about in lots of discussions and over the study that LRO produced would be to take just those gross receipts, so just the receipts that are related to licensing or advertising on subscription services, when the network doesn't have information about the location of their customer, they are going to use 0.6% as the numerator and the apportionment ratio. So they're choosing a number, and this was, again, the result of lots of conversations between Department of Revenue and industry. But given that they haven't been able to identify those locations in the past, this is an attempted fix moving forward, given the changes towards this more subscription-based model in the industry. The second bullet point here is that it allows the audience method to be used for other broadcasting sales. So it's not that all of their broadcasting sales have to be apportioned using that 0.6. It's simply that that specific small bucket of sales that have been problematic in the past, they have this option, or they will apportion this way. And then finally, it allows an election for the audience method to apply to all receipts. And this is related to that Comcast ruling I mentioned earlier. So effectively, this last bullet point says, if you want to stay with current law and apportion that way, you can do so. You can use the audience method that you're using now and apply it to all of your receipts except for tangible personal property and real property. So that election is part of the bill, and it allows for that choice to remain for taxpayers. And then again, showing you the same diagrams as before, but indicating that there is a slight revenue decline from House Bill 2455 relative to the audience method. So remember, audience method is current law, and this would deviate very slightly from current law in a negative direction. And I'll talk about why on the next slide. So I've indicated, and I believe this was from the 2020 session when I presented this bill, I have indicated here that the two major policy changes are the applying this apportionment method only to broadcasting sales. That's number one. And the 0.6% in the numerator is the other main policy change. So in the first row here, to elaborate just a little bit, in current law, if you are a broadcaster, all of your sales except for tangible personal property and real property are apportioned using your audience factor apportionment method. This change in the second row of this table where, let's see if you can see my, so the change here, this says, okay, if you're a broadcaster, only the sales that are related to broadcasting have to be sourced using that audience method. Otherwise, you can source them using the Oregon's general rule for intangibles. So it's taking this wide, I'd say wide category that we have now for broadcasting receipts and narrowing it to have a narrower scope for companies like Disney that I mentioned earlier, or any of these companies that have other revenue streams that they might want to apportion differently. Like I said earlier, the expected annual revenue decline is about $10 million when we switch from audience to commercial domicile. But these changes that are outlined in the bill are relatively small compared to that. And so that's the overview of the bill that I have, and I'm happy. I will stop sharing my screen now, and of course I can answer any questions.
I don't see any questions right now. I'll wait a moment in case someone is trying to raise their hand. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Thank you, Caitlin, for that great presentation. It's all sort of slowly coming back. It may take a few reviews for me. But can you, we noted that when we changed from audience factor, we lost $10 million in annual taxes. And we know that these new adjustments will have some impact. What is the overall expected, how is the overall expected revenue predicted to where are we gonna wind up after all this?
Sure. So Chair Nathanson and Representative Marsh, on average, we expect the annual revenue collected under the audience method to be about $10 million. And then from my last slide, the decline from switching from this current law method to the policy under House Bill 2455, that would be roughly a $600,000 decline. So relative to the $10 million, it would be $0.6 million in decline. So that would leave at $9.4 million relative to $10 million annually expected.
Okay, thank you.
And how does that compare to where we were 4 years ago?
Right.
The way the statutes were at that time.
So Chair Nathanson, do you mean, if I could ask a clarifying question, do you mean when we were under commercial domicile?
Or yes.
Okay. Yeah. So under commercial domicile, collections, I think we're, I still have my, so I'm gonna be careful here because of disclosure issues, and I wanna make sure I'm very careful about that. I believe that when we went from audience to commercial domicile, that was a $10 million decline. Moving back to audience is about a $10 million increase. But again, over that time period, legal cases were changing, as was Oregon's taxation of the intangible services. But we saw, again, $10 million about decline when we moved to commercial domicile, nexus arguments being decided in there, and now we expect about $10 million in annual revenue moving forward. And if that doesn't answer your question, I'm happy to look into more specifics to see what I can provide with given disclosure issues.
I don't want to do anything that would be a cause of concern because of disclosure. But this is the sort of thing that sort of can make your head swim. And yeah. What are you comparing it to? What's the baseline that you're trying to compare it to? A very generalized kind of summary might be, and please correct me if this is wrong, might be that this is what we're seeing today and what we almost took care of last year. We were poised to complete it and didn't, is the subject of a pretty complicated or tedious negotiation, and that in the end, the revenue to Oregon is not as much as it would have been in one comparison, but in another comparison, it's still more than it was, if that makes sense.
Yes, Chair Nathanson, if I'm understanding correctly. So under the audience method versus this bill we're considering, there would be a slight decline. But if you were comparing it to commercial domicile, there would be an increase in collections due to this.
Mm-hmm. Representative Marsh, does that sort of get at your inquiry also?
Yes, it would be great, Rep. Nathanson, I would add to your comment to see those numbers on paper, just so that we could understand what the changes have produced. Thank you, Chair.
Yep, I can absolutely put something like that together.
Are there other questions about the presentation before we move to public testimony? I don't see any. So at this time, we have four people signed up for public testimony. I'll take them in the order that they were received. And are you all able to unmute yourselves? The first will be Melissa, then John, then Marjorie, then Joe. So, Melissa, you're up first.
Great. Thank you so much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, yes, indeed.
Wonderful. Good afternoon, Chairwoman Nathanson, Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke, and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Patak. I am Vice President and Senior Counsel for State Government Affairs for the Motion Picture Association. I'm here on behalf of MPA and our member companies, who are the owners of most of the major television broadcast networks and most of the national cable program networks currently operating in the U.S., and increasingly, most of our companies also have streaming services. And let me just say at the outset, thank you to Caitlin and to Chris for all the attention they have given to this issue over a number of years. And that was like a graduate seminar, what Kate took us through and her presentation. So really very much appreciated. We are in support of House Bill 2455 to provide for appropriate apportionment for network and cable program broadcasters. This bill represents a compromise that the staff of the Legislative Revenue Office advanced in last year's legislative session. HB 2455 provides that for a taxpayer who is a broadcaster, its market for sales is in Oregon if its subscribers or audience is in Oregon. The bill states that the taxpayer sales factor shall be determined, that's a quote from the bill, using third-party ratings information as well as information from the taxpayer's books and records. This is an important provision because too often the DOR has relied on population and has been unwilling to consider the information provided by the taxpayer that establishes the broadcaster's audience. The bill also provides for a floor or a minimum if there is insufficient information to determine audience or subscribers. The broadcaster will use the 0.6% multiplied by the broadcaster's receipts from licensing and advertising to subscription services as the numerator of the sales factor. As part of this compromise, the bill includes a provision allowing a platform broadcasting company to elect audience as the apportionment method. A platform broadcasting company includes a cable service provider, a direct broadcast satellite service, or a multi-channel video programming distributor. The election would be effective for 5 years. In providing for the election, for broadcasters commonly owned with a cable service provider, a direct broadcast satellite service provider, or a multi-channel video programming service provider. The bill addresses the changes that have occurred in the broadcast industry, from business mergers to the development of the new streaming services. The bill retains audience as the apportionment method for those companies with various business units that are commonly owned to streamline the determination of their tax liability in Oregon. The bill modernizes the definition of broadcaster and provides a definition for platform broadcasting company, which reflects business operations and is intended to address controversies that have arisen under existing law. We believe this legislation will provide consistency and clarity both for the taxpayer and for the state, and we urge your support for HB 2455. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Committee, are there any questions for Ms. Patak? Well, don't go far in case there is a question that comes up. Next, John Powell, Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Vice President, Vice Chairs. I was just going to ask Representative Pham if she wanted to change committees right now, pick a different committee.
I'm loving it.
this issue is very complex. I tend to be a worrier, and that's a weakness for those of you who don't worry about things. I have lost more sleep over this issue over the last few years than any issue I've worked in the legislature over the last 45 years. It's so complex, and it changes all the time in the ownership and the development of the industry. One lesson I learned in listening to the old tapes of the 1989 hearings is toward the end of a session is not a real good time to make law. The words that were used were a little bit less than deliberate, kind of made sense. And I think the parties in the last minute negotiations thought it was better than doing nothing. And voila, we end up with a law that required years of judicial interpretation. I'm not sure the courts fully understood all of these issues as well. So here we are. trying to resolve a lot of very technical issues. And I have to say, as Melissa did, your staff performed way, way above average taking this on. And they were able to work with the Department of Revenue and the Motion Picture Association in coming to this this bill that's before you. And it was hours and hours of work, for sure. We're excited, too, about Betsy Imholt now being the director of the Department of Revenue. Marjorie Taylor, that you'll hear from soon, has a great legislative background. And as legislative director at DOR, I don't know Joe, but I assume he's a straight shooter as well. And these are good people. And I think going forward, the relationship with this industry and the Department of Revenue will be on good stead. So, Madam Chair, rather than trying to confuse people anymore about how the technical issues on this, I think we could just be available for questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions right now? I don't see any at the moment, but yes, we do have one. Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question for John Powell. I wasn't quite sure I totally understood. Could you talk a little bit more about some of the changes? It sounds like you were saying that policymaking at the end of a session when things are rushed can lead to quick decisions that then lead to having to negotiate for many years afterwards. Can you explain a little bit more some of the regrets and considerations that you wished had been considered further?
Yes, and I don't have I have so many files on this issue that I probably couldn't find it short of an hour because they're paper files. And I tend to work, due to my age, as much with paper as I do electronically. So I have these huge files, but in the last minute negotiations on the bill in the 80s, with one word change in the statute, I think it would have made a world of difference in the interpretation of those statutes, particularly with the Department of Revenue and ultimately the courts. So to be in essence, I think the law needs to be very specific. Put the words on the paper that you mean, and that's not always easily done. And then in addition to that, you have to keep the law abreast of the times, because since the 80s, before there were probably cell phones, this law was written, and it's still very broad, and it probably includes people that don't know their broadcasters in the definition. This bill is aimed at trying to resolve some of those issues. There'll likely be more in the future with other groups, perhaps, as the law is administered going forward. But technically, I think it's important to say what you mean in the statute and on the record so that everybody concerned knows what the law is.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Marjorie Taylor, you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor, the Legislative Director at the Department of Revenue. And we just want to acknowledge the long and complex conversation associated around this policy. And today I brought Joe Royston, who can help provide some context about our feelings on the bill and also address the testimony that we've provided on this particular bill.
Thank you. Mr. Royston?
Yes, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Joseph Royston, manager of the Corporation and Estate Section at the Department of Revenue. Our program staff have evaluated House Bill 2455 and determined that it is identical to Senate Bill 136, which is currently being reviewed in the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, and also Senate Bill 1529 that was considered last year. At this time, we see that the bill proposes to change how sales of broadcasters are portioned in several ways, which Caitlin has done a great job of outlining for us today. However, we continue to evaluate provisions of the measure and how they may reflect the conversations from 2020. But certainly I wanted to take this opportunity to make it clear that the agency is willing and able to implement House Bill 2455 as currently drafted. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Committee, do you have any questions for Department of Revenue? Okay, I'm going to wait just another half a minute or so to see if there are questions, any additional questions for any of the panel that we've heard from Ms. Patak, Mr. Powell, or Department of Revenue representatives. I don't see any hands going up.
Oh. Sure, Nathan,
thank you all for being great. With us. Yep.
Sorry.
I do see a hand.
My hand in at the last minute.
There we are. Yes, Representative Smith.
So, quick question for the Department of Revenue. As you're concluding your statement, you said that the department stands ready to implement as the bill is written. Do you anticipate there will be any fiscal impact to the agency that Ways and Means is going to need to consider?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Representative Smith, I don't know that we have any tangible evidence of a revenue impact per se outside of what the Legislative Revenue Office has provided. I think for us, we recognize.
Fiscal impact. I meant to say fiscal impact.
Oh, very good. No, I don't believe. Excuse me, Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith, members of the committee. At this time, the fiscal impact should be negligible. We don't anticipate that this is going to redirect work in a meaningful way for us. The taxpayer base is relatively small in the grand scheme of things, and so we don't expect there will be a significant impact to our work within this industry.
Awesome. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, could I ask a question? I'm signed up on the next bill. I signed up twice. Do I have to go to the other link and click in?
I'm going to have to ask staff to answer that. I don't know.
Again, no,
you can stay right there, John.
Thank you. Demonstrating my age again.
In other words, you can keep your same seat in hearing room A and don't have to leave and come back in.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any other hands. Is that correct? Mr. Alanak, I'm ready to close the public hearing. Do you see any reason why I can't?
I do not see any reason why you cannot. I think you're ready to move on.
Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2455. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2453. LRO.
Okay, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. Yeah, House Bill 2453 is a sunset extension bill for one of the expiring tax credits that's upcoming in the biennium. So this is the first tax credit sunset extension bill the committee has seen so far. The one in question here, House Bill 2453, has to do with the Oregon Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. And again, the bill is just moving that sunset a standard 6 years into the future, which is the way that these tax credit extensions have been set up to facilitate that review of the tax credit. So Madam Chair, I'm happy if you'd like any background information on the tax credit review process or on this credit in general. It is part of the report that we did prepare.
Committee, we do have enough time. Unless I hear an objection, I would like Mr. Easton to give us just a small bit of information. This is a really technical topic that isn't part of what we usually handle. I'd like to put it on the record.
Okay. So yes, Madam Chair, again, this is part of the tax credit review process. In many instances, these bills are being assigned to a policy committee that has kind of a policy hook to the underlying tax credit. In this case, this bill has not come from a policy committee. It was assigned directly to the House Committee on Revenue. But the credit itself, so the design of this credit has to do, as I was saying, the Oregon Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. And there is some background information in the SMS and then also attached in the meeting materials as well. We have the report excerpt related specifically to this credit. But this has to do with insurers here in Oregon. And in the event an insurer becomes insolvent, the association, which is the acronym OHIGA, pays claims to the policy beneficiaries of that insurer that becomes insolvent. And the cost of that is more or less recouped through an assessment on the other insurers doing business in Oregon. Now, that assessment then is where this tax credit comes in. And the credit is equal to the value of that assessment, but it's taken over 5 years at 20% of that total assessment. So if a corporate taxpayer is able to take a credit and use the entirety of the credit, it effectively shifts that cost of the assessment from the insurer onto the general fund through the credit. And that's the general purpose of the credit, is to more or less shift that cost of that insurer that more or less went out of business, shifting that to the general fund to cover those outstanding liabilities. Again, we do have information on kind of the cost of the credit. Happy to provide anything else. And there you will find more detail in the attached report, but that's a pretty high level overview for the credit extension.
Okay, thank you. We have two people signed up to testify today in the public hearing. John Mangan and John Powell. In that order, please. Why don't you proceed?
Madam Chair, I noticed that Representative Reschke had his hand up.
Oh, I don't see it. I do now. I wonder if I'm on a delay. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Pham. Kyle, I'm looking at the meeting materials, and I see that it looks like this tax credit was used quite a bit in the early 2000s, but hasn't been used hardly at all or claimed there was a little blip in 2018. So it doesn't look like this is a very expensive tax credit, but that's probably because we haven't had insurance companies going out of business. Is that an accurate description?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, that is true. Yes, you can see to the chart that this is a pretty sporadically used or infrequently used. What we've seen in the 2018 is there actually has been Penn Treaty became insolvent recently. So we are expecting the use of this credit to go up for the next few years. I think the total assessments have been about $8.8 million that's been assessed to date. Again, how that relates into the credit depends upon how many of the corporations are actually able to use the full amount of the credit. But yeah, that was part of the reason of including such a long term in that chart in the meeting materials, is to show use can happen when an insurer goes insolvent, and then it more or less can stay pretty low for quite a period of time. And then right now it looks like we will see another surge for a few years that we'd expect to see in the tax data as that becomes available in the next few years.
Madam Chair, a follow-up?
Okay, and then we'll hear from Representative Marsh after that.
Okay, thank you. So Kyle, just so I understand, you were saying that you get the tax credit, but it's spread over 5 years. So if I'm a insurance company, I'm assessed $100, then I can take a tax credit for the next 5 years of $20 each. Is that kind of the way it works?
Yes, Representative Reschke, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, Kyle, if you could say a little bit more about the public purpose. In the staff report, the summary, it says public purpose is to subsidize the cost of insurance guarantee assessments with general fund resources. It seems like there's a really specific obligation there for the state to pick up the costs incurred when an insurance company goes out of business. And I'm wondering if you can say more about the derivation of that and or other similar situations for other kinds of entities. In other words, are there other similar tax credits or similar direct governmental supports in place when a company goes under?
Yeah, Representative Marsh, in kind of doing some of the review on this, and one of the things we look at in trying to establish a policy purpose, because in many cases we don't find that specifically stated in statute, is to try to go back and look at the committee hearings when it was originally enacted and when it's been discussed in the past. And that's where some of the discussion came up of trying to shift some of that cost over to the state effectively. Some of the discussions that came up previously in committee hearings included that the credit, the way it's set up right now, it is a 20% credit taken over 5 years, or 20% of the credit is taken each year. So it's spread over 5 years, but there isn't a carry forward. It's not a refundable credit. So there, unless a taxpayer has sufficient tax liability in each of those 5 years, it does have a tendency to spread some of that cost to the other insurers, the non-insolvent insurers as well. Historically, we've seen it at about 65%, but it can definitely range of how much of that credit actually gets used. It depends upon the individual taxpayers. But that was discussed a little bit, where in some cases, it's not shifting necessarily the 100% of the cost, or at least we haven't seen that historically. So it kind of balances that a little bit. Did see that a number or a majority of other states have something similar to this as well. To your point of, I don't have an example that I can think of off the top of my head of where there's like a similar situation of kind of an insolvency in another business or something like that where the state steps in. Could definitely try to do some research on that, but I didn't come across that in preparing the report, but it's not something I specifically looked into and didn't find, though.
Thank you. Chair Nathanson, just one comment. I'd be interested. When banks go under, what happens, or when other similar important institutions go under, does the state pick up some of the leftover obligations as we are here? Thank you.
Okay, Representative Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question very similar along the lines of Rep. Marsh's question. Do companies that pursue the credit get vetted to understand why their company couldn't meet its obligations and became insolvent? What are the qualifications to be eligible for the tax credit?
Yeah, Representative Pham, the tax credit itself it's available to the insurers that are not insolvent. So one of the, I guess, membership in this guarantee association is required. So all insurers are required to be in this association. And so if an insurer becomes insolvent, initially that cost gets spread to the other insurers, and then they can take this credit to more or less repay that. So I think it's the ones that are not insolvent, that are still in business, that are picking up the cost initially for that insolvent insurer.
I see. Thank you very much.
Mr. Allenack, I wonder if this is an appropriate time where I could ask someone from DCBS, Department of Consumer and Business Services, to add any information or perspective they might have on these questions that we've just heard. And if they are available, I'd also like to understand, you know, in a lot of situations, to protect consumers, which could be either individuals and residents or other businesses, but to protect a group of people, sometimes we require bonding. I'm still not clear on why we have a public subsidy as a mechanism rather than something else. And maybe DCBS could help us understand that.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm a senior policy advisor with the Division of Financial Regulation at DCBS. I'm also joined today by Greg Lathrop, who's manager of our insurance institutions section, which reviews insurer finances. And the department does not have a position on the bill or the underlying policy question, but we are happy to take questions about how any of this works or how it relates to our regulatory functions.
Do any of you available today have any other comments you'd like to make on this kind of mechanism? Is this kind of mechanism typical of what happens in all states or lots of other states? And how does this, it reminds me of reinsurance in a way, but how does this compare to a requirement for bonding to cover potential loss? It in a more general way, how should we be looking at this type of a tax expenditure?
So, Chair Nathanson, the tax expenditure piece of this is a policy choice for the legislature that we do not have a position on, but the underlying mechanism with the Guarantee Association is something that is present in some form in all 50 states and some of the territories. It's a common part of our kind of framework of consumer protection around insurer solvency. And one possible analog might be something like the FDIC, where there's a sort of insurance against losses above a certain level if a bank goes insolvent, and that is a federal function, but the regulation of insurance is a state function, and so this is something that is generally done at the state level, is my understanding.
That's helpful, thank you. Committee, are there any other questions from for LRO or for the agency before we take public testimony? I think we're ready to move to public testimony then. Mr. Mangan and then Mr. Powell.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Nathanson, vice chairs, and members of the committee. My name is John Mangan. I'm regional vice president for the American Council of Life Insurers. It's a trade association of 239 companies who are licensed in Oregon, and all of whom are members of the Oregon Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association by law. Fortunately, both Mr. Powell and I have been around long enough that we can hopefully explain how all this works, the strong rationale behind it, and a little bit of the history that'll give you a sense of the policy that we have in play here. Obviously, we strongly support the bill. The Guarantee Association was created in the 1980s. It was really a partnership between private companies, between Oregon's regulators, the Department of Financial Regulation, and the legislature to protect consumers in the rare event of an insurer insolvency. And Representative Reschke is correct. It is very rare. This is one of the few tax offsets or credits that you periodically review that the beneficiaries of it never want to use. Our companies work really hard never to take this credit. It's not a desirable credit. It only happens if there's an insolvency, a shortfall in that company that we cannot otherwise assume. The member companies in this association actually do all of the work, the accounting work and the legal work. We assess ourselves for the administration of the association. And then if there is a shortfall, we assess ourselves to pay into a fund that protects policy owners. To answer another question from legislators, it is unique to our industry. It was voluntarily set up by our industry with policymakers. It's somewhat analogous to the FDIC for banks, but that's a federal program, as you know. And it's generally, Chair Nathanson, a pre-funded program. So they pay a premium on assets, and they continue to pay it, and it goes into a fund. Our assessment really comes after the fact. If a company is insolvent, we figure out what the shortfall is, and then we assess each other to pay for that shortfall. The tax offset is a component that the legislature put in to recognize that the companies are actually making a voluntary sacrifice and putting their own funds out to protect policy owners of an insolvent competitor, in some cases a competitor who has been mismanaged or made, you know, wrong choices. But the incentive of the tax offset is to make sure that Oregon state regulators do an excellent job of regulating those companies, and I can assure you that they do an excellent job, and they work under a robust framework of solvency protection laws that are passed by a national regulator group called the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. Those regulations are uniform across the country. We improve those each year here in the legislature in Oregon, and we help the regulator actually put those in effect so we don't have to deal with these insolvencies very often. So it is a uniform approach. It's something, again, that the tax offset helps offset the cost to our companies over a five-year period. I would point out that a company still takes a loss on its assessments. So over 5 years, the time value of money and the discounted cost of capital, we will recoup on average about 75% of the amount that we're assessed. And so again, that's a recognition of what we're putting forward. It's essentially a tax-free, or excuse me, an interest-free loan to the state to protect, well, number one, to keep coverage in effect for policy owners. I'm proud to say, as a former chair of the association, we're not aware of any Oregon policy owner that's ever lost guaranteed coverage. We're very proud of that. Companies are able to recoup some of the lost capital that they put forth, which seems fair because we all had a hand, I guess, regulators in the state. We all take some responsibility for what happens when somebody goes bankrupt. And hopefully this has minimized the impact to the state, to its policy owners, and to the economy as a whole. So it's been a great success story. Again, it's not something we want to use very often, and we work hard to make sure it isn't used very often. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Very helpful testimony. Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Mangan? Let's go to Mr. Powell. Mr. Mangan, don't go far in case we do have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Vice Chairs. This morning, my son sent me my testimony on this issue from 6 years ago. So I've been through this this before, and it's nice to have John with his experience precede me. The other thing about John you should know is John was a longtime employee of Standard Insurance in Portland. So he knows, that's why he was the chair of the Oregon Association and knows it much better than I do. But I think that the ultimate takeaway here is that this program is basically a national program. It is designed to protect the consumer, the end consumer of the product. And so I think Representative Marsh's question about other industry, I don't know of another industry that protects the consumer this way. And as Mr. Mangan pointed out, it's also unusual in that you're paying the debts of a competitor who may have been underpricing their product in competition, because it is in fact those who write that particular line of insurance who are asked to pay the bill. And so that's why insurers favor strong regulation of insurance by commissioners around the country, including our own state. And they do a credible job, and they're always on guard, and they do periodic, in-depth, basically audits of insurance companies. That's why bankruptcies are infrequent. So with that, I'm just gonna stop and answer any questions along with John.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, it's good seeing you. I think I understand the legislation. This is something I've seen in the past, and I think I understand the consequences. Can you help me, though, to understand the risk? I understand it's significantly low. That's what's been testified to us today. What are those primary factors, though, that would lead an insurance company to default? What are those primary risks? I'm not looking for everything under the sun. What are those two or three things as legislators we ought to be aware of as to why an insurance company could fail?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Smith, that's a great question. And let me give you a couple of examples. John mentioned underpricing, but there's another way this can happen. Let me take you back to 1991. The biggest insolvency of all time was Executive Life in California. They're aggressively marketing annuity products and guaranteeing 13% interest rate returns at that time. They were way over promising. They were investing in junk bonds to fund these high returns, and the value of junk bonds suddenly dropped. And all of a sudden, between day one and day two, the company was several billion dollars short on paper of being able to meet its promises. The regulator in California had to step in because they said, you don't have enough money on your books. And so the mistake there was the regulator realized that investing in junk bonds, a highly volatile investment, and making promises that were too great, you know, was a fatal flaw. After that happened, state regulators, Oregon's regulators and around the country, started passing a series of laws that regulated how much you could invest in different buckets, including junk bonds. So a downturn has been avoided, and insolvency has been avoided on that basis since then. They've also addressed investment in real estate, mortgages, other bonds. So investments are a key. Another one is simply over-aggressive marketing, as John Powell said. If a company is underpricing, it can lead to a shortfall. Now, the commissioner is always monitoring pricing, always monitoring a company's books and their insolvency, and it requires every company to hold a surplus fund to make sure they have adequate capital to cover all their claims. And if the regulator gets wind of a company underpricing, he will he and his staff will step in and take corrective action. And that's what we rely on. That's why we support the commissioner and his staff in these strong regulations, because we don't want to see one of our competitors engaging in any of these risky behaviors, because we're going to end up paying the price. And of course, the state will too. We both have a stake in making sure that doesn't happen.
Thank you. If I can just follow up very quickly.
Sure.
Chair Nate.
Sure.
I appreciate those comments. I would share with the committee, about 20 years ago, my son was in a horrific accident and through a settlement ended up getting about $600,000 with this company I'd never heard of called AIG. And at the time I said, well, gosh, what happens if something happens to AIG? And I'll never forget, a room full of experts all looked at me and said, AIG is too big to fail. Well, gang, we all know what occurred in 2009-ish in that era with AIG and others. And so I think while we look at this tax credit, and I know that's the focus of our conversation today, we do need to put, just an asterisk, if you will, to remind ourselves how important Oregon's Insurance Commission is to ensure that perhaps we never have to use this tax credit, even though it is a valuable tool to protect folks. So thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me share that thought.
Thank you. Representative Levy.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. In my younger days, when I was getting my master's degree, actually my first one, I also sold insurance for State Farm. And so that brought me back to thinking about the massive wildfires in California and the horrible, horrific home loss and loss of life. Did we see any major insurers in California end up going bankrupt because of those fires and loss of life? And should we be worried about that going into the future with the amount of timber that Oregon has and the questions we now have on how dry the timber is in the rest of the
Madam Chair, John Powell and one of my clients is State Farm. I can assure you they're solvent and will continue to be solvent, notwithstanding the losses of property and life. Something on the scale of those losses is and in part due to regulation. An insurer can only promise so much without resources to back up that promise. So that's part of the regulatory scheme. And that's part of what the commissioner does day in and day out is to assure that.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. And thank you, Rep. Nathanson.
Representative Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to all the presenters. I have a question. I remember when I was a graduate student studying climate change, I was really fascinated to find out that the insurance company and the insurance industry is actually at the forefront in studying climate change because they are experts in risk assessment and trying to assess future. I mean, it's their job to assess the future, especially decades from now and the world that we'll inhabit. I'm curious if I noticed that people were talking about the assumptions that we've, you know, the way that we've used the number of times insurers have gone defunct is going to be similar to the future. And I was just curious if when somebody could speak a little bit to the impact that climate change will have in the future. I did a brief Google search just now on climate change and life and health insurance, and I found a study that says climate change poses several risks to life and health insurance. Do you have any thoughts about the ways in which, as Representative Levy mentioned, there will be impacts to wildfires and increasing extreme heat events and things that will have an impact on loss of life? And I'm curious how you think that will impact the industry.
Madam Chair and Vice Chairs, John Powell again, represent some property and casualty insurers. It's a very difficult for me to assume the role of explaining how the insurers view climate change. There is concern and there is an ongoing effort, and they help fund studies to make those types of determinations, and as well in many cases support mitigation of carbon release and that sort of thing. So there is concern, there's just no doubt about it. And there's quite a bit of literature about the concern over time of climate change, both on in terms of the rising sea levels in communities that are close to the ocean, in terms of wildfires and that sort of thing. So it's a continuous study, and just like all of you, there are concerns. The solutions are a different story. I'm not sure the insurance industry has direct solutions to the issue of climate change, but they are aware and they do study it.
Madam Chair, if I could offer an additional comment.
Yes, go ahead.
Representative Pham,
Excuse me, you just need to state your name for the record as you start talking.
Once again, John Mangan with the ACLI, and I just was trying to respond to a comment. One clarification is that there are really two guarantee associations in Oregon, one for the property casualty companies, which cover fire and disasters, and one for life and health, as you pointed out. Just for the record, I want to make sure those are distinct. With regard to your climate question, even life and health insurers, which don't insure property, are very concerned about climate change and are continually monitoring how that may affect human health, how it may affect the investments we make, because we make a lot of investments in energy and other things that are changing in this world. So we're monitoring that and, of course, working closely with regulators as to that changing environment to make sure that our investments are strong and that we're resilient going into the future as well.
Thank you. Yeah, my main point was just how it was incorporated into your assessments of the likelihood of a future insolvency. But thank you very much. That's very clarifying. Oops, I meant to put my hand down. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions for this panel? I don't see any now. Okay, Mr. Mangan, Mr. Powell, thank you both for your helpful presentations. The information was clear and useful. And I didn't see any additional questions for you. So, Mr. Alanak, do you see anything remaining before I close the public hearing? I didn't have any other requests to testify after those two.
I think you're done with this one, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Now. Yeah,
thank
for
you.
Now. Yeah, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2453. Mr. Alanak, any final thoughts from Legislative Revenue Office before we adjourn for the day?
I don't think so. The tax credit, this is just so the committee is aware, we've had a lot of conversations this session about the tax credit review policy. So there are a number of tax credits that are in policy committees that, depending on what those committees do with them, they will come to this committee. So I imagine this one will be waiting until the rest of them arrive to figure out what the next step is, just in terms of the process. This one's a little unusual in that it came to your committee first.
Thank you. So it will be in a holding pattern for a while.
I would expect so, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you all. Committee, I don't think there's anything else. Speak up immediately if there's something you need to raise before I adjourn. Okay. We're done for the day. See you all tomorrow. We're adjourned.